This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Senate voted by a 4-1 margin to ask for quarterly reports from the Bush administration on progress in Iraq. The proposal states that, quote, 2006 should be a period of significant transition to full Iraqi sovereignty, unquote. In other news connected to the war, over the weekend, American troops discovered a secret detention center in the basement of Iraq's Interior Ministry building where the detainees were allegedly tortured. Interior Ministry officials reported that the torturers appear to have been police officers. My guest James Fallow says it will be difficult for the U.S. to pull out of Iraq until Iraq has a reliable security force, but they're not even close. Fallows wrote the cover story for the December issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called Why Iraq Has No Army. Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. James Fallows, welcome back to Fresh Air. In your story, you say that you think we're basically in an impossible situation. Would you describe the quandary that you think we're in?
The quandary we're in involves the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq. On the one hand, everybody now acknowledges, concedes, warns about the fact that the very presence of those troops is an irritant in Iraq and is one source, not the only source, but one source of the continued insurgency, the continued violence, including the fact that those troops are themselves targets. And one of the things which is very desired by the insurgents is to kill as many Americans as they have. So on the one hand, the American troops can't really stay there. On the other hand, they can't really go because now 2.5 years after the fall of Baghdad, the elimination of Saddam Hussein, there really is not any other force for order or even such order as exists in Iraq now other than the U.S. military and some few allied forces, mainly British. So the dilemma is we can't stay and we can't go. The way out of the dilemma, allegedly and desirably, would be the creation of a native Iraqi security force. But why that's difficult is the main thing I was trying to look at in this article.
And before we get to why that's difficult, what do you think the consequences would be if we decided, well, it's just too difficult to stay and, you know, there's so many attacks against the military now, so we will just go? What would the consequences be?
Well, if you look long into the future, you know, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, you would assume that one way or another this would sort itself out for Iraqis. And if they are to be one country, which historically they've only been, you know, for a relatively recent time of history, but if they are to be one country one way or another in terms of ethnic balances, military pressures, democratic institutions or non-democratic institutions, they'll work it out in the shorter term in which we all live, which is to say the next year or 2 years or 5 years. I think there's a wide assumption the country would essentially break into with the famous three components, with the Kurdish component, the Shiite and Sunni regions. And the reason that would matter to the U.S., apart from just the carnage that might be involved for the people there, is that the central Sunni district, which is the heart of the insurgency now, it is assumed would become essentially an insurgent-controlled, warlord-controlled, sort of tyrannical-type region that would have as its main reason for being an outright enemy of the United States. What was the role that Afghanistan played under the Taliban before September 11th as a haven for terrorists is what it is assumed this Sunni stand would play if the country just broke apart.
One of the reasons why it's difficult for us to pull out of Iraq now is because there isn't a strong military or police force to maintain order in Iraq. It was the Coalition Provisional Authority that dismissed most or all of the Iraqi military. What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, this is going to be historically one of the hotly debated issues about the Iraq War. We're all familiar with the debates about, you know, WMD intelligence and all the rest. But I think when military historians and diplomatic historians look at this war, they're going to spend a lot of time looking at this question of why one of the first things that Ambassador Bremer did as the head of the new Coalition Provisional Authority was to get rid of the Iraqi army. Before the war, the Bush administration had planned to keep the Iraqi military in place, stripping off, you know, just the generals and commanders, some of the generals and commanders, on the argument that while these people had some disadvantages, they were associated with brutality in Saddam Hussein, they had the advantage of being a force in place, some force for order. They had their own transportation. They could do some good in the reconstruction. So on a narrow basis, the administration decided they would work with this pre-existing army, sort of as had been done in Germany or Japan, where you strip off the very top layer of real bad guys and deal with the average soldiers. As a side note, one complication in stripping off the top layer of the Iraqi army is that it had about 10,000 generals in it. The U.S. Army, which has about the same number of troops, has 300 generals. The Iraqi army had 10,000 generals. So that's a whole separate question. After the invasion of Iraq and the fall of Baghdad, there was, you know, widespread disorder. And the judgment on the ground by Bremer's people was there was no more structure in place. You know, the barracks had been looted. They'd been emptied out. And so their judgment was the pre-existing advantages were no longer there. And so they might as well just, you know, recognize the disadvantages and clean house and start over.
What was the argument against dismissing them?
The main argument against this step of dismissing the Iraqi army is that you instantly created a hostile class. These were people who suddenly had no paycheck but who still had their weapons and now had a motivation to be against the U.S. occupation. So everything was suddenly became harder once you had these cashiered soldiers in the country.
What are some of the reasons your sources in the military told you were having such a hard time training the Iraqi military and Iraqi police? On the one hand, it seems like it shouldn't be that big a deal. You know, you train them, they learn, they do their job.
Well, there's sort of an ascending series of difficulties, starting with the fact that training an actual professional army is a very hard thing. You know, the United States military spends years and years and years trying to develop an officer corps, and it has all these graduate schools, and it thinks it's going to take a long time to shape people's careers, and even creating your ordinary Marine, to the extent that's not an a self-contradiction, or your ordinary Army soldier, is regarded as a real effort of changing some. It's not simply teaching people skills. It's sort of changing their identity. They go in as civilians and they come out as Marines, or they come out as soldiers. So doing this in a country where the starting point of the military culture was entirely different was a real shift. And the pre-existing Iraqi military under Saddam Hussein had officers who were largely parasites, and it had ordinary troops who were largely cannon fodder. And in between, it did not have the crucial element that actually makes the U.S. military work, which are the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants, you know, who the grizzled sergeants who make everything operate. So trying to create that was one problem. Just creating a military would be difficult in any circumstance. Then you have the situations in Iraq itself where you have all the famous ethnic tensions and the fact that the main effective force were the Kurdish militias and to a degree the Shiite militias. So having some national identity was tough. Then just to kind of cut off the list at 3 or 4 rather than 20 items, there were incentives inside the U.S. military. Historically, training duties on the whole have not been really for the A-team in the military. There are exceptions like the Special Forces and the Green Berets, which do a lot of training work. But generally, the combat commands are the glamour commands, and the training commands are the less glamorous commands. So there was not that much emphasis before the war and the early occupation within the U.S. side of really putting a lot of emphasis, a lot of talent, a lot of pizzazz on the training missions.
You mentioned that a lot of the people in the military are part of factions. You know, they're Kurdish, they're Shiite. They have an ethnic identity above and beyond Iraqi. So are the ethnic differences that we're seeing in Iraq in general reflected in the army, and is that holding back the military from being a really well-functioning military?
There certainly are. There has been a distinct effort, especially in the last year by the U.S., to try to have not purely ethnically defined military units and to have as many sort of combined units as they have and to post people outside their home region, although that creates all kinds of tensions when you have, you know, Sunni troops in a Shiite area, et cetera. So there's emphasis on being it more nationally Iraqi and less purely ethnic than it used to be. But certainly, as was described to me, the essential nature of most of these troops is still regional. One man I talked to, Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, who wrote a great book on suicide terrorism, was saying the way to imagine this would be as if the victorious Union forces had gone into the South after the Civil War and tried to have units of white and black Southerners fighting side by side. You had, you know, 200-plus years of history making that difficult for the U.S. and so too in Iraq.
Now, your military sources told you that we're doing a better job training the military in Iraq now than we were early after the invasion. What are we doing different?
Part of the difference seems to be a simple increase in emphasis at the personnel level. A man named David Petraeus, a lieutenant general in the Army, who is one – at each era of military history, there's a handful of people who are sort of the obvious high flyers or fast movers. And he has been one of those. He was the commander of the 101st Airborne during the actual war. In the summer of last year, he took over command of the training mission. And since he himself was so obviously a man on the rise within the military, this was taken as an important sign that, this was a more important mission. He's been able to shift a number of the tactics and strategy for the training. Just to give two examples, the main measure or metric, as they say in the military, for how the Iraqis were doing, it used to be things as crude as how many people were on the rolls, which included a lot of ghost soldiers, or how many were so-called trained and equipped. And under Petraeus, this had been shifted to a unit readiness or unit capability measure in four brackets. There's much more emphasis on having American advisors be connected for a long time or embedded with Iraqi forces, and a number of other sort of nuts and bolts sorts of things, which are having an improving trend on the Iraqi force.
But some of the people who told you that also told you, but it's too late.
It's in an ultimate sense, you know, it may or may not be too late, and just in a no, there's no hope sense. But what they did say is that as the situation of training Iraqi troops has been getting better, the surrounding situation has been getting worse and getting worse faster, and the troops are improving. So by a measure of the gap that there is to fill for Iraqi forces, the whole effort is falling behind because the situation is getting worse faster than the Iraqis are being prepared to deal with it.
Can we talk about this and say, well, who knew? Who knew that it would be this hard to train the Iraqi military in a security force? And who knew that there would be an insurgency? Do you feel like you knew?
In the summer of 2002, which is to say 9 months before the combat began, I was finishing an article for The Atlantic sort of interviewing people who'd run past occupations. And this was published as an article called The 51st State. And all of them said then that for a very, very short time, the U.S. is going to be seen as a liberator and it'll become an occupier. Language will be a problem. Dealing with the existing Iraqi army will be a problem. The ethnic tensions, of course, will be a problem. Keeping social order after these years of oppression is going to be a problem. So before the war, there were all sorts of people that I, as an average unclassified journalist, was able to talk to. After the war began, I was able to re-interview a larger set of people who showed me the actual documents, again, not classified, but saying there were sort of prescriptions and checklists and plans of all the things that the administration should have been aware of because its own people were preparing these reports in the months before the war and the early months of the occupation. So I think one could claim that the whole WMD controversy involved things that nobody really knew for sure. But the maintenance of order, it's very much harder to make that case because lots of people should have known that problems were ahead.
My guest is James Fallows. He wrote the cover story for the December issue of The Atlantic. It's called Why Iraq Has No Army. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist James Fallows, and he has the cover story in the new December issue of The Atlantic Monthly, and it's called Why Iraq Has No Army. Now, I want to get back to what you were saying before, that you talk to all these experts. You, a journalist without access to classified sources, talk to all these experts who warned you that, you know, who shared their warnings that the problems that we're now facing, we would be facing. So did you ever ask members of the Bush administration their reaction to these warnings that you were getting from other experts? And what did they tell you? Warnings that there'd be an insurgency, warnings that it would be hard to keep order, that it would be hard to train the military.
I wish I could speak with more authority about the Bush administration's answer to these criticisms or more firsthand authority. The unfortunate reality is that since 2002, I haven't been able to get interviews from people in the positions of political authority, although I've spoken to more and more military people. In January of 2002, I interviewed Paul Wolfowitz, and in the fall, I spoke to Doug Feith, but nobody at the top since then. What I understand from inference and reporting and off-the-record conversations and all the rest is essentially this. Number one, the administration would say, oh, sure, it's easy to second guess. You know, if you look at the horoscopes, you'll find anything predicted you can come up with, and so it's irresponsible to go back through the record and say people warned against X, Y, and Z. What about all the things they warned against that didn't happen? The answer to that, of course, is there was a consensus of the main bodies, the CIA, the Army War College, lots of other people, about what the main problems would be. I think the other main theme that's come from the administration is there was one big thing that they failed to prepare for. It wasn't WMD, it wasn't the looting, it wasn't things like that. They didn't realize, as they now see it, that Saddam Hussein all along had been planning an insurrection. All along, in their view now, he'd been planning to sort of play possum and then have his bitter enders come up and lead that kind of insurgency that's underway now. But there's certainly been no indication in public statements by anybody in the administration that they regret anything about the occupation.
Well, you say you've had trouble talking to members of the Bush administration. You've spoken to a lot of military leaders, but many of the people who, not all, but many of the people you quote are anonymous. And why do you think they feel they need to remain anonymous?
This has been, I should say, a really bitter pill for me, or a bitter bargain, because something I've tried very hard to do in lo these many decades of writing about this kind of issue is to name the people I am quoting. And I've taken pride in having few or no unnamed sources in most of the stories I wrote. What's been impressive or striking to me in the last 2 or 3 years is that with each passing month, it's been easier to talk with people in the military, but harder to be able to quote them by name. Easier to talk with them because I think there is a sense of concern, disaffection, whatever you want to call it, among people in the military about the way things have been going for their institution and in Iraq. At the same time, you can't quote them by name because the sense of lines being drawn and authorized and unauthorized statements, that's become clearer and clearer. So I'm able to quote in this article a few general officers and colonels who were authorized by the Pentagon to speak with me, but a large number of people with whom I've been maintaining email correspondences while they're in Baghdad, while they're in Fallujah, while they're in Tikrit, saying, you know, here's what's been going on, but I can't quote them by name.
We've been talking a little bit about why Iraq has why their army was basically dismissed and how difficult it's been to train an Iraqi army and police force. You are puzzling through a question that, you know, Congress has been debating and America in general has been debating, England has been debating, which is, so what do we do now? Do we pull out? Do we stay? If we stay, for how long? If we pull out, what kind of timetable do we present? You've thought this through. In your personal opinion, what do you think we should do?
Well, I don't pretend to have an answer that eludes the rest of the civilized world on this front. What I do try to add to the discussion is this degree of clarity. I ended up thinking that there really was a pretty stark choice that we face, that if we want to constitute an Iraqi force that is capable of preserving order in that country so that we can leave in an honorable fashion, by which I mean not with civil war immediately on our heels, not with mass ethnic slaughter immediately following our withdrawal, something at least as decent as the withdrawal from Vietnam. That's my standard, where there were sort of 2 years where the South Vietnamese army was able to hold off the North Vietnamese. If that is our goal, it's going to take a very long time to do that. That even if all the training plans for the Iraqi army go as planned, it's going to be many, many years before they have air support sufficient to their needs. That is both airplanes and helicopters. It's going to be a very long time before the intelligence systems the U.S. has are adequate. All sorts of other logistics factors. So if this is to happen, it will require quite a long-term commitment and also a different sort of human commitment. One real problem in the training exercises so far has been the one-year rotation period for Americans. We have a sort of a presence of continual fresh faces because they're taken in and out. Americans now stay there too long for their own good, but not long enough for the training mission. So it would mean having more people there for a longer period of time, more people who are trained linguists, all sorts of other serious commitments. So on the one hand, making this work in the way that we envision of a decent departure from Iraq, I think, will mean facing a commitment through the next presidential term, whoever comes after George Bush, to be there in a serious way. Not as many soldiers as now, but quite a few. If we're not willing to face that serious commitment, it seems to me, we should face the fact that we cannot leave there honorably. And we're going to leave dishonorably. And so if that's the case, then we might as well do it sooner rather than later. But that, to me, that's the main thing I want to add. It seems to me that clear a choice.
What do you think the debate is like within the Bush administration about this? Do you have any idea?
I wish I knew. I wish there were signs of two things. One is signs that the president himself exposed himself or sought out really contending points of view. For example, on the question of whether Iraq has helped or hurt in the larger effort against terrorism, as far as I've been able to tell, there's no indication that the president himself has ever wrestled with that idea. You know, he has often stated, you know, time and again that Iraq and the war on terrorism are inseparable and the same. It would be nicer to think that he had come to that conclusion after some debate than just coming to that conclusion. As a side note here, I love listening to the C-SPAN tapes on the weekend of Lyndon Johnson's conversations. And Lyndon Johnson, I mean, the tape recordings of LBJ. It was obvious that man was tormented over Vietnam. Signs of a president being tormented over this difficult situation might be worse for him, but more reassuring to the country. I guess the other thing I would like to see from the Bush administration is some sign that they're addressing the serious challenges to their Iraq policy. What we get is a lot of responses to straw men. You know, some people say we should cut and run. Some people say the Iraqis aren't worth it. Having them actually address the serious complaints about their policy would be a welcome thing. But I don't know what they're actually saying to each other.
Well, James Fallows, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His article, Why Iraq Has No Army, is the cover story of the December edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.